funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did Mexico become consumed by such violence, and what role has U.S. policy played in the escalation of drug-related crime and chaos? By some estimates, the Mexican drug wars have claimed the lives of more than 70,000 people since 2006, including not only active cartel members, but also a shocking number of innocent civilians. And as my guest today will tell us, the escalating American effort to punish drug offenders has had serious consequences on both sides of our southern border. Journalist Michael Dybert explores all this in his new book, In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the Gulf Cartel is old, it's had a lot of power, and has operated with very little fear of law enforcement interference. Can you tell us about its origins?
Yeah, the Gulf Cartel can trace its roots back to a guy named Juan Guerra, who was born in 1915 in Tamaulipas, which is the state in Mexico that abuts the Rio Grande Valley in the United States. So towns like Brownsville and McAllen, and also Laredo, Texas. Nuevo Laredo is on the other side of the border. And it got its start in the very last days of a prohibition of alcohol in the United States, which was another, another policy that we had that I think any reasonable person can assess as having been disastrous for the 13 years that it was in place. And after, Juan Guerra began smuggling all kinds of different things back and forth across the border. And then, it eventually expanded into marijuana and heroin and things like that. And the Gulf Cartel are very unique and very interesting because the majority of Mexico's cartels can trace their roots back to Sinaloa, which is a state on the Pacific coast. And what was originally the Guadalajara cartel, which was a kind of mega cartel that broke up in the late 1980s. And from that cartel was spawned the Sinaloa cartel, the Juarez cartel, and the Tijuana cartel. And so the Gulf Cartel historically has been a bit of a regional anomaly in the history of Mexican drug trafficking.
And what did that sort of regional influence allow the Gulf Cartel to do? And how did that affect the way they operated?
They ruled and continue to rule Tamaulipas. They are the true government of the state of Tamaulipas. And they had extremely close connections to the PRI, which is, of course, the political party that ran Mexico for 70 years. It was out for 12 years and is now back in with Enrique Peña Nieto, both at the local level and at the federal level. I think, if you look at the history of governance in the state of Tamaulipas, the history of the governors there, for example, the last four governors, it's pretty shocking. I mean, one, Thomas Yarrington, who was a guy who was a close associate of Rick Perry's, who's the governor of Texas, who was at Rick Perry's inauguration and was widely praised by him, was indicted both in the United States and Mexico for his efforts on behalf of the Zetas, which are the spawn of the Gulf Cartel and the Gulf Cartel itself. He's now missing. The other governor, his successor, is, in Europe somewhere and is also, was found that one of his main bodyguards was a Gulf Cartel sicario or assassin. And the current governor, the head of his personal security, was recently arrested for having a role in the murder of the state director of public security.
What effect does that sort of cartel control over government and elected officials have on the sense that regular people have that there's any point to voting, to looking to government to solve any of its problems or to even protect it?
Well, I guess what I would say, first of all, it's important to recognize that the levers of power go both ways. Both a question of the cartel controlling the government, but also the government controlling the drug trade. And the reason that the drug trade is so pervasive in Mexico is because it happens with, at the local, at the state, and sometimes at the national level with official sanction. And it happens on both sides of the border that way. I mean, there's often the way it gets reported in the United States is somehow that there's all of this drug-related corruption in Mexico that somehow magically stops at the Rio Grande. Well, there's plenty of drug-related corruption in the United States, too. And, our economic system benefits greatly from the continuation of the war on drugs, both in terms of U.S. banks that launder drug money, in terms of the private prison industry that makes millions of dollars a year from incarcerating people, in terms of the firearms industry, which makes lots and lots of money selling weapons that then find their ways into the hands of the cartels.
All right, you mentioned Los Zetas, who are the which once had an alliance with the Gulf Cartel and now are chief rivals. First of all, talk about how that alliance worked and then why it broke down.
Yeah, well, after when Juan Guerra, the guy who founded the Gulf Cartel, kind of reached his dotage, he let his relative Juan Garcia Abrego take over. Then, when he was arrested, the guy who took over was Osiel Cardenas, who was a native of Matamoros. And in about 1997, Osiel Cardenas decided that he wanted more of a professional kind of enforcement wing to confront the Sinaloa cartel, who were his great rivals at the time. And so he reached out to a group of Mexican Special Forces guys who defected, basically, and became the original 30 members of Los Zetas, which means the Zs, which is just a kind of radio code for high-ranking military officials in this particular group, in this particular military group in Mexico. Now, after those 30 guys defected, around 30, they were joined over time by members of Los Cabiles, who is the Guatemalan Special Forces unit, who have a terrible history in terms of the civil war in Guatemala, and also by, you know, various common criminals, including Miguel Trevino, who was grew up largely in Laredo and Dallas, actually, and still has a lot of family in Dallas. And, you know, they became the shock troops, I guess you would say, of the Gulf Cartel, who already had a very nasty reputation. Now, the falling out of the Gulf Cartel and the Zetas occurred in the beginning of 2010 when a Gulf Cartel lieutenant killed a close associate of Miguel Trevino in Reynosa. And ever since then, the two cartels have been at one another's throats, and there's also been, you know, infighting among the cartels themselves in different parts of the state, in Reynosa and Tampico, which is in the southern part of Tamaulipas near Veracruz. So it's been a tremendous bloodbath that's been going on for quite a number of years now.
How does the operational style now of Los Zetas compare with that of the Gulf Cartel?
I mean, they, I would say that the Los Zetas are the cartel that kind of has the greatest image of fear among a lot of people in Mexico. And there's an idea, certainly, that perhaps they victimize more the average population. Now, this is a reputation that I don't know if necessarily, I mean, when you look at what most of the cartels do, it's pretty nasty stuff. Particularly now that, you know, with the Gulf Cartel having micronized the way it has, since a lot of its leaders had been captured and killed, you have situations where different strains of the cartel are fighting over different neighborhoods and even sometimes different blocks in Reynosa and Tampico and places like that. It's not the situation where it was when Osiel Cardenas was running it, where there was kind of like one boss. Now everybody, there is no one boss, so everybody wants to be their own boss. But the Gulf Cartel, diminished as they are still very good at trafficking lots of drugs and very good at killing people. And when I was in Reynosa in December of 2013, so just a couple of months ago, about 6 months ago, you know, I was driving around there and I ran headlong into a Gulf Cartel roadblock that had been set up in the middle of a sunny Saturday afternoon, a couple of minutes from the U.S. border. There were guys with assault rifles pulling people out of cars, you know, and that was happening in broad daylight. And they seemed to have absolutely no fear from the security services of the United States or of Mexico.
How would you compare the way that we have looked at the drug problem and dealt with the drug problem and the way that we have tried in this country to combat international terrorism, where in the ideal, in many cases, is to sort of take out the leadership and not worry quite as much about the people on the ground?
The logic of dealing with the problem of drug addiction and drug abuse in the United States, in my opinion, is completely upside down because we're approaching a public health issue as a military campaign. And it's also incredibly hypocritical because, you know, I mean, the United States, you know, has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, and half of America's federal inmates are in prison for drug-related offenses. Now, there's on record Bank of America launder drug money, HSBC launder drug money, Wachovia, which is now part of Wells Fargo launder drug money. You know how many bankers are in jail for that? None. And I find that whole, you know, that whole approach to the drug problem as if the only way we can solve it is by hammering the poor in the United States and by turning Mexico into a slaughterhouse completely upside down and wrong. And I think if you look at countries that have, you know, taken a different approach. For example, if you look at Portugal, which legalized personal possession of substances, including heroin and cocaine, in 2000. Now, that's 13 years ago, and there's quite a bit of data about how that happened. You know, people did not run out and start all becoming drug addicts simply now because personal possession was legal. And in fact, among teenagers, who are, of course, are a very vulnerable group when it comes to narcotics, the rate of addiction went down. And, you know, if you look at the Netherlands, which also has a fairly tolerant drug policy, it's something similar. I think the only solution to the violence in Mexico and the violence in the United States, you know, I'm sitting in a city, Miami, which has neighborhoods like Miami Gardens and Liberty City where drug-related violence is rife. And also I lived in New Orleans for a long time, and you have neighborhoods like Pigeon Town and Central City and Gert Town where there's also a lot of violence. The only way to properly address this problem is through the decriminalization of narcotics, which has started already at the state level in some cases.
Why do you think we have such a hard time overall as a society even asking these questions? It seems it's only been in the last few years that there have even been serious discussions about liberalizing drug policy.
I think the rhetoric surrounding it, as you alluded to earlier, it's kind of the rhetoric of terrorism, that you're either with us or you're against us kind of rhetoric. And the whole idea of somehow that in Mexico there is this savagery going on that has nothing to do with us. Mm. Well, interestingly enough, you know, I mean, if you look at a lot of the kingpins of Mexico, the drug cartels, you know, Miguel Treviño grew up largely in Dallas and Laredo. La Barbie Edgar Valdez grew up in Laredo. El Kilo, who was the head of the Zetas unit in the San Fernando Valley in Tamaulipas that committed one of the massacres there, he grew up in Washington State. So this idea, and also there is the, you know, coincidentally, the fact that, you know, the United States has a population about less than half of Western Europe, of the European Union. And, you know, we consume more cocaine a year. We consume about $37 billion a year. They consume about $34 billion. So the idea that somehow we are not culpable for this violence, that we are not responsible for what's going on in Mexico, is a kind of amnesia, not even an amnesia, because you would have to understand it before you forget it. But it's a kind of willful ignorance that I really hope, if there's one impact that this book has, I hope that it shakes people free of that a bit.
Michael, what kind of demand is there for marijuana and narcotics within Mexico?
I mean, you know, that situation has certainly increased in recent years, and I think it's increased largely, you know, because, well, obviously, you know, Mexico became a bigger kind of transshipment point. It has always, I mean, Mexico's produced heroin and marijuana for quite some time itself. But, you know, I think now we're seeing more local consumption of Mexico, of drugs in Mexico than we had seen in previous decades. I mean, I still think it's relatively infinitesimal compared to the appetite in the United States.
Do you think the growth of that demand has anything to do with the growth of the illegal drug industry operating within Mexico?
Oh, yeah, sure. And I think it also has to do with the fact that, you know, these border towns that used to be somewhat seedy, like any border town anyway, they're not necessarily nice places on either side of the border, on any border, but, you know, which used to be kind of quiet, seedy places, have now become these just lawless areas. And as you saw in Ciudad Juarez, for example, and now you see in Tamaulipas, when this drug violence comes in, it's followed by a general breakdown of law and order that goes beyond simply the drug trafficking industry. And, you know, that's why, I talked to a human rights advocate in Juarez in 2010, which was a particularly grim year for that. And, you know, he was telling me that kind of human life has no value here anymore.
Journalist Michael Dybert is with us today from the studios of WRLN in Miami. His new book is called In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. You can join the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Michael Dybert about his new book, In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. I want to talk just for a moment here about Saint Death or Santa Muerte. This is a figure that has become a sort of familiar anti-icon in recent years. Can you tell us about her cultural origins and what she actually represents to Mexicans?
Yeah, well, Santa Muerte actually has a very long and a very old history in Mexico. I think because of the recent prevalence among it above in narco circles, that people have mistaken it for some kind of recent creation. And essentially, Santa Muerte is a folk saint that is appealing to people in it's been called a cult of crisis, and I think that's very correct. And obviously, if you're living the narco life, where you're wondering whether your best friend is going to kill you for a drug load or something, that kind of qualifies as being in a crisis, I guess. So that is basically the kind of history of her. And she also, there's another saint that another folk icon, I would say, that you see often, which is Jesus Malverde, which is the generous bandit who's traced from Sinaloa. And it's a legend of a bandit that was killed that then gives offerings. So you'll see him a lot depicted with a mustache, and you'll see a lot of hats with his image on them along the border and things like that.
All right. We are well familiar in Texas with the fact that there's a long and complicated history between Mexico and the United States, starting with decades of conflict over territory. Can you give us a sense of how that has shaped international relations between these two federal governments over time?
Well, sure. I mean, I think the thing is a couple of things I would say. I mean, Carlos Salinas, who was president of Mexico in the late 1980s and early 1990s, was someone who I think whose presidency, I mean, who was elected illegitimately by fraud, who was somebody whose presidency, despite the links to the drug trade in various aspects, was welcomed by the United States because he was very warm in his rhetoric towards the United States and towards things like NAFTA, whereas some other presidents may have been more nationalistic. The thing is, the PRI is not, I would say, an ideological political party. In other words, it's not a political party that's motivated by any hard kind of ideological adherence to policies of the left or the right. It's kind of a bit of an opportunistic, all-consuming political kind of monster, I guess you would say. The other thing is that's important to know is that, because of these bi-national history that we have between us and Mexico, these families are living on all sides of the border, And the thing is, it's not something inherent in the Mexicans that makes them violent. Because if you look at a place like Brownsville or a place like El Paso, relatively, they have fairly low rates of crime compared to the rest of the United States. And these are the same families that are living in Matamoros and that are living in Ciudad Juarez. So it's nothing inherent in the Mexicans that makes them violent. It's the policy that's creating the ideal market conditions for criminals that is bringing the violence to them.
How and why did the United States become, as you say, fixated on the problem of illegal drug use by Americans in the 1970s?
This is a good question. I mean, I think, which I don't honestly have a perfect answer for. I mean, in some ways, despite what can be a kind of licentious culture, in some ways, the United States is also very puritanical in other ways. And I think, even down to the idea of you have to be 21 to drink, but you can, be in a lot of places, but you can be 18 and go to Iraq or Afghanistan and get shot at, which I think a lot of people in other countries find kind of strange. And, I think the whole, again, looking at Richard, the drug war basically started with Richard Nixon, in the early 1970s, and then was kind of amplified especially by Ronald Reagan. But if you look at the policy of different administrations, whether they be Republican or Democrat, it hasn't changed a whole lot appreciably to me. I mean, now, the Obama administration is talking about commuting some sentences for drug crimes or whatever. But I think it's really a drop in the bucket in terms of the magnitude of the problem. And I hope that these initiatives that we're seeing at the state level may eventually over a period of years, I'm sure, create some kind of critical mass where at a federal level, the United States has to reexamine its drug policies.
What kinds of resources is the U.S. devoting now? And you alluded to this a bit earlier, but to try and stem the tide of drugs crossing into the country from Mexico, and are we attempting to cooperate in these efforts with the Mexican government?
Well, I mean, the federal government in 2006, the federal government's idea of how it was going to stop drug trafficking was the Secure Fence Act, which was a failure on so many levels. I don't even know where to start. It's kind of like an embarrassment of riches. I mean, I think it was Jeanette Napolitano, who was governor of Arizona at the time, that said, show me a 50-foot wall at the border and I'll show you a 51-foot ladder. And, the idea that these cartels that have multi-billion dollar diversified criminal enterprises that range from people smuggling to narcotics to, counterfeit DVDs and clothing and things like that are going to see a fence at the border and say, oh, no, now we better stop. Dealing drugs or sending drugs to the United States would be laughable if it didn't result in so many deaths. Now, what this militarization at the border has done is it has pushed immigrants coming to the United States into an ever narrower channel from which they can get here, which has been a perfect tool for the drug cartels and the criminals to control and kill them, as we saw happen to many immigrants in the San Fernando Valley in Tamaulipas a couple of years ago.
Mexico at one time had a very strict policies to try and keep handheld weapons out of the hands of many people. Have those policies weakened, or are they simply not being enforced in the same way? It does seem that there is just so much machinery in the hands of people who would wish to do harm south of the border.
Well, I mean, a lot of that machinery is bought in the United States. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have one story in my book of a guy who was arrested in April 2009 in Houston, who had legally bought over 100 military-style firearms, which ended up in the hands of cartels in Mexico, including one of the guns was used in an assault on the Guerrero State Attorney General's office in Acapulco that left seven people dead. You have kind of disastrous programs like Wide Receiver and, Fast and Furious, by which the United States kind of walks guns into Mexico in this idea that somehow they'll be able to track them and take down cartel kingpins. So, I mean, our firearms industry is the best one-stop shop that the Mexican cartels have.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Dormand who says, the First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is one of the most valuable and essential pillars of our society. I shudder to hear about abuse of the media by drug lords in Mexico. Do you have any thoughts, Michael, on how journalists in Mexico might regain some freedom to report?
I mean, it's an extraordinarily difficult situation that journalists are in, particularly in the border region, because, in a place like Tamaulipas, basically you must do what the cartel tells you, or you'll get killed. You don't really have a choice. It's not as if you can say, no, I'm not going to. And the thing is the cartels, the Zetas, the Gulf Cartel, they have media person, and the media person will basically be in charge of telling local reporters what they can and cannot report on. And the punishment for that is death. I mean, there was a very well-known Proceso. Proceso is a very well-known publication in Mexico. A reporter in Jalapa, which is the capital of the state of Veracruz, which is immediately to the south of Tamaulipas, who was murdered in a still unsolved crime. And there have been, so many journalists killed in Tamaulipas, in Chihuahua, in other areas of Mexico. And, living and working in the capital, I guess, it gives some sort of protection, but a lot of, if you look at Proceso or some other publications, when they're reporting on the drug war, a lot of times the stories will not be bylined. Mm-hmm. It will just say, staff or something like that. And so it's a very, very difficult situation they found themselves in. And that's why, websites like Blog del Narco or Borderland Beat have become really important, because they're ways for people to disseminate information that maybe the media in those areas can't. But they're also a bit of a double-edged sword, because these are also websites which, the cartels are obviously aware of too, and they use to kind of talk to one another and terrify one another. I mean, there's the cartels picked up their whole public decapitation video, execution video, modus operandi from the insurgents in Iraq. Mm. And now it's kind of become de rigueur thing that you have, you know, or these grisly videos of people being killed and dismembered and things like that. And that's ways that the cartels use to kind of talk to one another and terrify one another.
There are, of course, laws in Mexico against these activities. Can you talk about the strategies that the cartels use to ensure that local and regional police forces do not interfere with their activities?
Yeah, I mean, everyone, you know, there are kind of gradations of the pay scale for what a police commander will get from a cartel, what a journalist will get, what a local official will get. I mean, police chiefs can get something. I have the exact figure in the book, but it's something like $9,000 a month, which, you know, for a cartel is like change you find under the couch, basically. They have, you know, any police chief who steps out of line risks a terrible, terrible fate. I mean, they're listed in the book. I mean, a lot of them, but I've kind of lost count of the numbers of police officials who have been murdered in Mexico in the last 6 or 7 years. I mean, some of them, you know, probably were involved in the drug trade, but not all of them. And it's an extraordinarily difficult situation. And that's, I think, was partially behind Calderon's logic of dispatching the military to some areas of Mexico, was that he thought that the local and state police were so corrupt that they were not kind of reliable partners for trying to battle these narcos. And the thing is, I mean, in Tamaulipas, people will tell you that the Gulf Cartel is made up largely of former and active duty Tamaulipas state police officers. But the thing is, of course, the military is itself not immune from, you know, corruption. And they're not trained to do domestic law enforcement duties. They're trained to fight enemies in war. And so when you dispatch the armed forces to civilian populations to try and enforce the law, that sets up a very dangerous and potentially deadly dynamic between the armed forces and the civilian population.
It's really easy to get caught in the crossfire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about this expression that is familiar in Mexico, plata o plomo?
Yeah, silver or lead. I mean, it basically means, again, you know, this goes back a bit to the relationships the cartels have with the media in northern Mexico. So it's saying you either take my silver, which is, you know, money of some sort, or you'll get the lead, which is a bullet. And, you know, that was an expression that was popularized originally by Pablo Escobar from Medellin in Colombia in the 1980s. And it's certainly an expression that has a lot of currency in the Mexico of today.
So for regular people, it would seem, you know, in this country, many people believe that if you're not involved in the drug trade, chances are you will be safe from it unless you happen to be very, very unlucky. There have been lots of innocent people at parties for teenagers, people just literally in the wrong place at the wrong time or assumed to be someone they were not. Can you tell us some of those stories?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you're thinking specifically. There was a massacre of teenagers in Ciudad Juarez a couple of years ago, which was basically a mix-up from everything I've been able to ascertain from going there, where the sicarios were the cartel de Juarez thought they were killing a group called Artistas Asesinos, which were the hitmen for the Sinaloa cartel in the city, and instead they wound up killing a group of kids who were celebrating their victory in the AA championships for sport there, which is, you know, the AA was the thing that confused them, evidently. And you have that same thing in Tamaulipas. I mean, you know, the highways of Tamaulipas are extraordinarily dangerous for anyone. And, you know, you can run into, anything driving from, say, Ciudad Victoria to Matamoros or from Reynosa to Matamoros. And I had a friend in McAllen, Texas, who said, you know, she had moved to the Rio Grande Valley, maybe 20 years ago. And she said, you know, 20 years ago, she would have thought nothing of getting off work in McAllen and driving to see friends in Ciudad Victoria over the roads of Tamaulipas at night, woman alone. She would have not thought that. But now, you know, you're taking your life in your hands. And the cartels institute curfews in certain neighborhoods. I mean, in Reynosa, the back roads of Reynosa, it's known by everyone at 8 p.m. those roads are clear. You know, you do not go out on those roads. If you live in those roads, you stay in your house because that's when they're moving their drug loads. And if you get caught there, then, you know, that's your life.
We have an email here from Tara who asks, how are certain towns affected more than others? It seems like tourist and American enclaves in Baja, Sayulita, and Cancun can be so safe compared to cities like Juarez. Or is this just an American illusion?
Well, I mean, I would say, you know, one of the places that has been the site of some of the most ghastly violence in Mexico in the last couple of years was Acapulco, which, you know, was a historically a great tourist mecca for Americans. But you had infighting, you had fighting between the Beltran Leyva cartel and the Zetas, and then infighting between different Beltran Leyva factions. And, you know, I think in some areas of, I mean, the violence, I would say, is not all over Mexico, but it's also not confined to the border, which a lot of people like to say. I mean, Cuernavaca, which is a beautiful colonial town where Malcolm Lowry set a novel called Under the Volcano, which is about a, maybe an hour and a half from Mexico City, you know, that's been the scene of terrible fighting and terrible violence. And so has some other places around in Mexico State, which is the state that surrounds the capital of Mexico, Mexico City. You know, so whereas I don't think the violence is everywhere in Mexico, I also think it's a mistake to say it's just happening at the border.
In some border areas, people who had the means have moved north of the border. What are people doing who can't afford to move that happen to live in the worst affected areas?
I mean, it's interesting that you say that because there has been some, you know, there have been some cases where the fighting in some of these towns, such as Ciudad Mier and others, you know, and these are places that are 20-minute drive from Texas, has gotten so severe that you've had actually internally displaced persons, IDP camps, spring up in you know, gymnasiums of neighboring towns and things like that. So, I mean, they bear it until they can't bear it anymore, I guess. And the thing is, my question I would ask, I suppose, to lawmakers in the United States who suggest that the solution is for Mexico's government to further militarize their struggle against the cartels, how much more militarized can it get than it is right now?
My guest is journalist Michael Dybert. We're talking about his new book, In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. We'll resume the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Michael Dybert from the studios of WRLN in Miami. His new book is called In the Shadow of Saint Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by emailing think@kera.org. Michael, how does militarization of the borders and growing government resources designed to fight the drug trade affect the tension between different cartels?
Well, I think, you know, as I said, it's making there is a smaller window in some ways of areas where drugs and people can be moved across the border. And I think that makes – and also the other thing to look at is the profit margin, which is tremendous. I mean, because the kind of more scarce – you know, it's just supply and demand. Mm-hmm. The more scarce a product that people want is, the more you can charge for it. So to give you a little bit of, you know, kind of context, I mean, in 2013, it was estimated that the profit from the – for Los Zetas, for cocaine alone. So one cartel, one product to the United States, one market alone that year was $350 million. And, you know, so the militarization is not obviously hitting their bottom line, but what it is doing is it's making life a lot worse and a lot more violent for people who live on the Mexican side of the border.
So if like tomorrow Hoffman LaRoche or some pharmaceutical company could start producing heroin and selling it over the counter, there would still be an illegal drug trade, though, would there not? Because these infrastructures are in place. There's the question of tariffs and that sort of thing. Would that really take away all the motivation for people who are doing it now?
I don't think it would necessarily take away all the motivation, but if you look at legal pharmaceuticals, which are also quite a deadly substance that are very well accepted in the United States, I mean, there are pill mills all over Florida. We have a real problem with that down here, and I think the idea that it wouldn't kind of negate all of the criminality associated with narcotics is not an argument that I really accept in terms of not negating most of it, because if you look, for example, because a lot of these substances, cocaine and heroin, opiates were legal in the United States at a certain point. They were made illegal, along with marijuana. When alcohol became legal again after 13 years of prohibition, the kind of criminal monarchies that had made all of this money by producing illegal alcohol and running illegal booze into the United States, they didn't keep doing it because there wasn't the profit that to be had that had been be able to be had before.
We have an email here from Jason who says, trafficking of children and adults thrives in Texas. What role do the Mexican cartels play in human trafficking?
Oh, I mean, they control it to a large degree. And, if you look at there was a very famous massacre that happened in the San Fernando Valley in Tamaulipas a couple of years ago. And the Zetas killed, at that time, it was over 70 people. And most of those people were immigrants from Ecuador, from Brazil, Honduras, places like that, that are trying to make it to the United States. Actually, a Salvadoran journalist named Oscar Martinez wrote a really great book called La Bestia, The Beast, about the trip on the train that immigrants take up through Guatemala, through Mexico, and into the border region. And I recommend people to definitely check that out if they haven't already. So, I mean, that is these drug cartels. In some ways, calling them drug cartels at this point is almost a misnomer because they're highly diversified criminal organizations, of which drug trafficking is kind of just one thing in their portfolio.
Is it possible to be elected in Mexico with no ties to unsavory organizations?
Well, I guess it depends on where and who we're talking about. I mean, certainly in the local level in Tamaulipas, the PRI's connections to the drug trade, to the Gulf Cartel specifically, but also more recently to the Zetas, are extremely close. The links of politicians in places like Sinaloa and Michoacán to the cartels there are extremely close. And, there's the Minister of Interior and the Attorney General of Mexico currently are both former governors of a state called Hidalgo, which is a notorious Zetas hotbed. I mean, Heriberto Lascano, who was the head of the Zetas for many years, grew up in Hidalgo. And the presence of the cartels in that state deepened and expanded when these two individuals were the governor. Now, the question is, did that happen because of them or despite them? And that question is, I think, still open to debate in many people's minds in Mexico and elsewhere.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Ethan in Dallas. Hi, Ethan.
Hi. My question relates to the organ harvesting in the northern states, I guess. I mean, it's more of an urban legend, of course, but most people I know who live there or from there, I mean, everyone talks about, kids being kidnapped, and it's just kind of on the hush-hush about it. I don't know. I haven't been or haven't read anything official about it. I was wondering if there's anything you had to comment on that.
I mean, there certainly is a great industry in human trafficking and human smuggling in the border regions in terms of specifically like the harvesting of children's organs. I haven't seen or heard anything about that specifically.
Can you talk about how the violence of the past decade or so has changed the overall culture of Mexico and the nature of what it means to be a Mexican, even with no relationship whatsoever to the drug trade?
I mean, much like Colombia in the late 1980s and early 1990s, and to some extent still today, and something that's also happening in Guatemala today as well, which we didn't get to talk about that much. But I mean, the violence associated with the United States' appetite for illegal drugs and our propensity for letting the cartels buy any kind of firepower they want here has shredded the fabric of Mexican society in a lot of these places. I mean, I think your listeners will know, I'm sure many of them are Mexican American. I mean, there's a great cohesiveness of the family structure in Mexico, I think. And I think that has been really battered by this violence because people can't protect their families anymore. You know, you can't protect your families in Mexico. I mean, you drive from Reynosa to Matamoros and it's putting your faith in God or whatever that you'll arrive alive. And, driving at night, forget it. Going to Playa Baghdad in Tamaulipas to take your family for a day on the beach, forget it. You can't do any of those things anymore. Your kids can't play out on the street in a place like Matamoros or Reynosa because they might get caught in some kind of gun battle. So I think it's had a terrible effect on children. You know, especially, I mean, if you look at, there have been studies done where kids in Michoacan and other areas that have been battered by drug violence are asked to draw images of their daily life, and the images are heart-wrenching and shocking and terrifying. I mean, you know, very bloody dismemberment, decapitation, things like that. So this is the world that this policy that we have had in place since the 1970s is helping to create in Mexico, and I think it should be changed.
Let's talk a little bit about Guatemala. It has been on sort of failed state watch lists for some time. The past year or so, some observers have seen some improvements and reasons for optimism. What can we learn from its struggles that could be applied to Mexico and to the way the United States deals with Mexico?
I would say anyone who sees any reasons for optimism in Guatemala is extraordinarily naive. The political parties in Guatemala are almost to one, linked organically to organized crime in the country, which historically in Guatemala has been dominated by military intelligence and former military intelligence. But recently, because of the drug trade and because of the move down of the Gulf and the Zetas and the Sinaloa cartel, has become more of a, I would say, an entrepreneurial affair that's not necessarily directly connected to military the way it used to be. I think Guatemala is heading for a pretty dangerous time in the next year or two. And I think, you know, Guatemala has suffered the fallout of Mexico's drug war and the United States drug policy as well. And, if you look at areas like Morales or Coban or the Petén, for example, these are areas in which the Zetas and the Sinaloa and the Gulf can operate with almost complete impunity.
When you talk about operating with impunity, we're talking about people walking around sort of in plain sight doing these things. There's not even really a pretense that these things aren't taking place.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I said, I mean, I opened with my book with a trip to a town called Morales in eastern Guatemala in 2008, and there were people walking around visibly armed. And today in Reynosa, you'll see guys walking around with assault rifles who have no earthly business being armed at all. And, the idea somehow, when I hear this rhetoric of kind of the U.S. Secretary of State or various drug czars or Homeland Security people or whatever saying that, you know, this or that marks a step forward in the war on drugs, I mean, it's so cynical. And again, I think I said something similar to this earlier, but it's so cynical and it's so ridiculous that it would make you laugh if it wasn't so deadly. And I think, you know, you can take down Osiel Cardenas, you can take down Chapo Guzman, you can take down all of these people. There are 100 people waiting in line to take their place.
Hmm. Is it your sense that the individuals who are crafting U.S. drug policy simply don't understand what's going on or that they don't care about what happens to Mexico?
I think there is no political courage in the United States to admit that the drug war is a failure, which we've all known it's been for many, many years. And I think in order to I mean, let's face it, we live in a society that has more or less resigned itself to having, you know, massacres in our places of higher education every couple of months, and we don't seem to have a problem with that. So what's the life of a bunch of Mexican campesinos? But I think, you know, there's just not a lot of political courage on the national level to address this problem. I think, however, if you look at the initiatives of states like Washington State or like Colorado, I think there is a move on the state level to recognize that the drug war has failed and to look at different ways to address it. And what I really hope is that these moves to decriminalization at the state level will reach a kind of critical mass where the government's, the federal laws are being ignored to such a level and so widely across the United States that they have to act.
Do you think marijuana alone would be enough, at least initially, to deflate some of this violence? Because
I don't think
no one's talking about legalizing heroin or cocaine.
I mean, I'm talking about that, mm-hmm. but they might not be talking about that. I mean, I think eventually that's the – I mean, if you look at what – you know, I mean, if you look at what Portugal did again, in 2000, I mean, that's 13 years, and they legalized personal amounts of all of those drugs, heroin, cocaine, pot, and there was not any great upsurge in addiction. And there, in fact, was a decrease in drug use among teenagers. And I think the idea that's – there is no compelling reason other than a moralistic one. Or other than one to keep the private prison industry booming and the weapons industry booming in the United States, there is no compelling reason not to explore the decriminalization of narcotics here because, you know, how many lives does it take before we re-examine the policy? It's 70,000 now in Mexico, however many thousand in places like Miami Gardens and Liberty City and you know, Central City and Los Angeles and other places. What's the number that we have to reach before we'll re-examine this policy that has failed? I want to know.
Do you think there's a class issue at play here in that Americans, perhaps incorrectly, tend to associate a lot of forms of drug addiction with the poorest residents of this country?
Well, sure, and you can see that in the rates of incarceration. I mean, you know, African Americans make up a relatively small percentage of drug users in terms of the entire United States, yet they're overwhelmingly the amount of people who wind up serving prison time for drug-related offenses. And that's another, you know, little bit of our own hypocrisy at work here.
How did you protect yourself, and how do you protect yourself when you're doing this sort of work?
I mean, you know, you tried to do things like not travel at night, things like that. I tried to do my interviews at my places and get out and not necessarily linger. And I mean, because there were some neighborhoods I was in that were cartel neighborhoods. But I mean, you know, it only goes so far because they have the halcones, the watch people all over the place. And they're obviously, you know, I'm not a familiar face in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So that's immediately attracts attention. But, you know, I mean, you get stopped sometimes. I mean, as I said, you know, in December I was stopped at that cartel roadblock in Reynosa and it could have gone any number of ways, but thank God it didn't. So I guess you just hope to trust your instincts. I mean, I've done this kind of reporting now for about 15 years, so I have some antenna, but that's no, you know, as you look at journalists who get killed in the line of work all the time, that's no ultimate protection.
Is it easier for a foreigner than it is for a Mexican national to do this work?
To some degree, yes. I mean, I would say to a large degree, actually. I mean, I can come back here, you know, mm-hmm. and someone living in Mexico can't. And I wouldn't say there's an ultimate protection offered to me by my nationality, but there's some level of protection being a gringo that it would be more problematic to be killed. But, you know, when you're talking about a group of people who spend, you know, every afternoon snorting cocaine and swigging Buchanan's whiskey, I mean, how much logic goes into it, I'm not sure.
The new book by journalist Michael Dybert is called In the Shadow of St. Death, The Gulf Cartel and the Price of America's Drug War in Mexico. He joined us today from the studios of WRLN in Miami. Michael, thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help today on the phones from Pablo Araúz Peña. We have Jeff Whittington as our executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.